Welcome to Culture Business, the international conference for fundraiser in the arts. Episode 6, The Sustainable Museum. How the International Spy Museum pioneered a new museum model without the need for traditional fundraising. By Gretchen Kos, Senior Associate, Director of Business Development, Gallagher Museum Services, United States.
So you'll have to excuse, this is a bit of an odd setup. So if I go back and forth in Rome, you know, just, you know, that's my style of moving around the room. As mentioned, our firm is actually involved on a different aspect than many of the people who are in this conference. We're actually dealing on the consultant side of designing and doing the interpretive framework and working with the fundraisers, the development directors, and the museums themselves. The reason that we thought that this would be a good example to show today is that we've talked so much about the changing landscape of what's happening with fundraising and the idea of just relying on contributions and donors is going to have to change. If you haven't already thought about other ways of gaining income, of looking to other avenues, I'd like you to take a look, even though you're probably, many of you are very different institutions, what I'd like you to take away from this is that there are different avenues for the fundraising and the sustainability of your institutions and museums, and we'll come up with questions at the end of this, but I'm going to take you through the odyssey of what we did with the International Spy Museum. And the first thing I'll tell you is that this building sits in L'Enfant Plaza in Washington, D.C. It is one of the areas that has a collection of not so appealing, brutalist architecture buildings. So you can see by the design of the building, we worked with Richard Rogers out of the UK, that it is the only angular building in the area of glass and metal that really sets a precedent in that area and has a presence. So the idea behind the Spy Museum started back in 2002. So we have Spy 1 and Spy 2. So the image that you just saw on the screen is Spy 2, which was opened this past year. The origins of this museum date back to the Korean War, where the lead philanthropist, Milt Maltz, was actually a codebreaker in the Secret Service. So his interest in what happens behind the scenes and the espionage and spy and what it does for the country's intelligence and for history has stayed with him since he was in the war. So he's always had an interest in history, but the first spy museum was our very first for-profit museum that we worked with in the United States. Our basic clients had been the Smithsonian, the National Park Service, the White House, the Holocaust museums in both Tel Aviv and Hungary. So we do a lot of work with not-for-profit institutions. So when we took this museum, our client, the Smithsonian, thought we were crazy. They basically said, there's no way this model is going to work in a city where you are living with the largest nonprofit organization in the world. And it is down the street. The original and the new spy museum are within walking distance of that. So the model that was created that we'll walk you through has some different aspects to it than any of the other projects that we worked on. I just think a little framing of what we do. We used to call ourselves exhibition designers and museum designers. Now it's more about the full experience and experience design versus just that very narrow funnel that is called museum design. So this particular museum is one that steps into both the education and the entertainment side of what we do. It's probably important just to show that our work spans the globe. We have offices in Washington, D.C., New York, Portland, and Singapore. We used to have an office in San Francisco, but what we were finding is that most of the people who are in the media and interactive world are now in Seattle and Portland, and we couldn't get them to move to San Francisco, so we now have a new office in Portland. We're about 130. And we range from graphic designers, architects, industrial designers, and media and digital designers. We also have content development in the firm, and as we'll talk about, the business and operations side. So I think that the important thing for us is that our expertise lies between those two worlds of the visitor experience and the business and sustainability. The one thing that I will tell you that it's going on about 30 years for me in this business, and it has gone through a significant change. I will tell you that what we know from our lead donors is that they want to know that you have a real lock on the vision of this project so that they can get excited about where this project is going and the framework, and they want to know that you know how to run this museum. You know what it's going to cost, you know how to right-size it, and you know how to sustain it. So when we're looking for our largest donors, we have found that that pairing of keeping the creative vision and the business and sustainability tied at the hip has made our largest donors feel comfortable that when they're being asked by many of you in the same city for the same pool of money, which projects are they going to put their money in and where do they feel the strongest? So when we say sustainability, I know that that word has a number of different connotations because I'm sitting in the room with those of you who have LEED buildings, you have green buildings. That's not what we're talking about today. When we talk about sustainability today, we're talking about earned income and contributed income sources exceeding capital and operating expenses annually and into perpetuity. It's not just when you open, it's beyond opening into the years that these museums should be able to sustain themselves. I think that one of the things that is very interesting about the first International Spy Museum is when it opened in 2002, as I mentioned, has anybody been to DC? Okay. Do you know where the National Portrait Gallery is? Gallery Place, Chinatown? 2002, it was like not an area you would like walking in. It was not well visited. It was not a pedestrian core. So we took over five historic buildings. The original museum was a total of 40,000 square feet, and it was a $40 million project. Completely paid for by Milt Maltz because he had both the aspirations for the collection and for the museum itself. We looked at five sites, five cities for this museum. So from the beginning, we were looking at both the subject matter and the space in which this museum would go. There were about 700,000 annual visitors in the space that we have now, and about 750 artifacts. I think one of the interesting things that really is the underpinning of this is that it was a for-profit museum that turned into a not-for-profit museum as of SPY 2.2. And then I'm going to go through the reasons for that and for what happened with this particular museum. But the underpinning of the model for this museum was that the retail, the signature restaurant, and the cafe and event space were the drivers behind the finance of this particular project. So most of the event space was booked 3 years out. There was not enough event space, so they would take over both the museum and the event space. And the idea of having the retail was the retail for this particular museum, everyone who walked out of the museum had something when they walked out. So the branding and the taking the thematic framework through the retail is another big part of this particular museum. Milt Maltz. So yes. Milt and Tamar, so you know when Ruth and Rose were talking yesterday about how long it takes for some of these relationships to build? We've been with Milt since 1998. He sold his company. It was a cable and TV company where his money came from. And because he had an interest in history and philanthropy, they have spent the last several decades giving to educational efforts, museums and cultural institutions, and medical issues. So he was the sole funder for the original museum. In the new model, he paid 50% of the model. As we look at expanding, so you saw the original cost at $40 million. The new Spy Museum is a $162 million project. It grew by 100,000 square feet. And one of the very, very interesting things about this particular museum is that you see what happened to the artifacts here? 7,000? It was 750 before. When you go from a for-profit to a not-for-profit, There are aspects of collecting and the ability to obtain artifacts that will change for you. In this particular case, there was a $30 million collection that was given by Keith Melton that was available to the museum after they switched to a nonprofit organization. And we're going to talk a little bit more about what that change means. But I think that the idea, oops, sorry, did that by accident. Bear with me. So the fact that we went from 40,000 square feet to 140, the visitors in the first 3 months, remember that it was about 700,000 visitors annually in the other museum? This museum in the first 3 months had 250,000 visitors. So one of the things that I think when you're looking at these types of museums, and the reason that I'm showing you some of the metrics and the changes in these museums is that these decisions were not made just because we had a space and we wanted to cover the entire space and take 140,000 square feet. We learned that we needed more event space. We needed more throughput because we did not have enough capacity. The original Spy Museum went to timed ticketing because we had such a heavy demand for the museum that we had to figure out how to do the throughput in a different way. The tickets for this museum, when you started in 2002, were $12. They are now at $24. Now again, one of the things that we'll talk about in the back end of the presentation is trying to figure out how to get the speaker notes to move on a PC. I'm not a PC person. But one of the things that we'll talk about is the idea that these ticketing is a really tricky subject, and the idea of add-ons. So if you have a 4D theater, if you have an AR or VR experience, the idea that some museums come out very, very high with their ticketing prices at the get-go, and then they don't do so well, so they go, I think we're going to drop the prices because maybe we'll get more visitors. That is the worst thing you can do for your institution. Start low with your ticket pricing, see how things go, and go higher. When you take your prices lower, it implies that you are not doing well, that you are making a move that is sort of in desperation, and it devalues that particular experience. So those are some things just to think about as you're looking at some of the costing models. The other thing that happened with this particular SPY 2 is that the original building lease was up at the end of this term. And so the price got so high for the building that it was no longer worth being in the building at that time. So doing a purpose-built building and right-sizing that building for exactly the programming you need, the event space you need, the retail space you need, and buying into revitalizing yet another neighborhood in the city that has been underutilized for years. They have tried, I can't tell you how many institutions have tried to go into this space and it has not succeeded. So it's that idea of giving back to your community and building something that has a connection. So this particular site is connected to the wharf that is a brand new area on the waterfront that DC has put quite a lot of money into, and it's doing very, very well, but it's disconnected. So there's L'Enfant Plaza, there's the wharf, and there's the mall. So the National Mall, the wharf, and L'Enfant Plaza are now a triad of a walkable area, and there's a critical mass there. It's built. So I'm hoping that you can see, I apologize if this screen is a little bit hard to read, but I want to talk about this idea of the visitor experience and the sustainability being tied at the hip. So on the left-hand side, you see that we're looking at sort of elevating the experience, educating and inspiring the visitors. We're looking at delivering form, function, and feeling. And when we say that, I will tell you that we've been talking during the conference in a couple of different conversations about many of our clients who are museums do not do a good job of branding themselves. They don't do a good job of marketing themselves, and they build an institution and think just because it's built, people will come, which is not the case in a lot of these situations. The branding and the feel, once you walk inside the Spy Museum, you know you've arrived, and the whole feeling of the lighting and the theatrics and the presentation feels like you're within sort of that world of being a spy. Then if you look at the very bottom, the physical exhibits and environments, the digital content and interactives, and the virtual engagement platforms. In the original Spy Museum, you were given a spy identity. And Unfortunately, we didn't have the room and the capacity in the historic buildings to be able to take the interactivity all the way through the building. So this particular building takes you in on a journey through the entire museum, taking on an identity and being able to go through the entire facility. I will tell you that part of that $162 million cost, when you look at the cost of doing interactive and digital media, it is very, very difficult to keep your costs at the low point that you might have been at 10 to 12 years ago. Having said that, we are very intentional with the way we use digital media, and it's not used for a wow factor. It is used as a powerful tool to be able to educate the visitor. On the right-hand side, when you look at the long-term sustainability issues, calculating acceptable risks, and I'll go into that, unpack a little more. Smart design, i.e. demand-driven. Again, going back into the idea that everything you're doing on the long-term sustainability is something that has a reason for the approach that you're taking. I'm gonna go quickly through this slide, but I just want you to look at the idea that these are the aspects behind the actual experience itself that are very, very important. And one of the really interesting things is the real stories. These are real individuals, there are real stories, and there's very, very provocative content, which is somewhat difficult in some of the cases of the stories that are told. So when you look at this financial planning framework, the idea is that there are those three prongs that we're looking at. We're looking at the market insights, which deal with audience segments, the site and the area, and the comparatives for the venues. In the center, we're looking at the cost structure. So when you're looking at your hard costs, your soft costs, and your capital structure, and then looking at the attendance, revenues, the self-operating versus outsourcing, and the efficient operations as that very, very important third leg of the stool. So audience segments are something that we don't have time to go into, but I will tell you that most often our clients choose too broad an audience. So you'll see that in this particular case, the visitors were 8 years old and mostly 8 years old and in that range with parents and families, both local and international, and people seeking something that was more of a bespoke kind of experience. The site goals, the adaptability and the intended use, the visibility and accessibility, and being near the accessible public transport and the major points of interest is a very, very important part of this metric. And then looking at the comparable venues, as you know, there are 100 plus venues in Washington, D.C. We have a little bit of competition to go up against. Hard and soft costs, I'm going to come back in the questions and answers to this because we don't have the allowable time, but the idea of looking at your construction, your core and shell, the one thing I can say that I would like for this room to know, because when we're dealing in Europe, Asia, other countries, the idea of doing a competition is the way that a lot of these projects come about. That is not the way we do the best interpretive design that is designed from the inside out versus the outside in, right? The sustainable strategies and the capital structure, and I'm gonna probably leave on this one so that we can have some questions. This particular model shows you that you can see the sponsors and donors are sort of a dotted line on the outside. It is the least heavily weighted of the way that we have gone about this museum. Now, remember that this particular model is no longer funded by one donor, right? 50% of what went into this museum was put in by Milt Maltz and Tamar. The rest of the funding came from tax incentives, debt bonds, and equity. Every single city and country has their own rules for what is available to you for tax incentives and for tourism incentives. So I think that as we're looking at some of the decisions and some of the things that you have at your fingertips in different countries, and any country, we have some of these incentives that are starting to come about much more in much more of a prevalent way. And then last but not least, I think that looking at attendance versus revenues, the biggest difference in this museum to any other museum that we have worked on is they do not depend on attendance for their revenue base. They depend on all of the other structure for the retail, the restaurant, and the events to bring the base to where they have an endowment. That is, so when the museum was endowed to the District of Columbia by Milton Tamar, An endowment came with it. And there's an endowment that will go into perpetuity with this museum. So I think that the idea of having all of these forms of the private events, the retail sales, the museum admissions, and the food and beverage sales, when you look at the idea of doing something that you own and operate versus having someone else own and operate, the idea behind that for both retail and food and beverage is you make less money if you don't run it yourself. However, you take more risk if you run it yourself. SPY is now running all of their retail and all of their F&B as an internal. However, all of their catering is done outside of house. They don't have a kitchen. They don't want to deal with those types of issues. So basically, they are self-sustaining because they learned a lot of lessons in 11 years of the first SPY Museum. So once you get your feet wet and you learn some lessons, the ability to go beyond that and have your own self-sustained income generator is much more feasible. I'm going to let some questions, we have some slides to give you some more information, but I'm going to go ahead and let some questions about.